This is either two people whose lives were overtaken by drugs and all the stress and everything that goes on, and they made a bad decision. They made a bad, bad mistake. Or this is two cold-blooded psychopaths who were planning and plotting to snatch an innocent little girl off the street.
Welcome to Crime Lapse. I am Eileen.
And I'm Charlie.
This is Complicity.
In February 2011, Rafferty was granted a change of venue from Woodstock to London, Ontario, because it was felt that he would not get a fair trial.
Jury selection began on February 27, 2011. Over 1,000 people were pooled and questioned to be part of the 12-person jury. The potential members were questioned on whether they felt the pre-trial publicity would affect their ability to do their duty. This took a week. The trial opened on March 5th in London, Ontario. Justice Thomas Heaney had warned the jury that the trial could last several months. Due to the nature and length of the trial, jurors were paid $40 per day from the first day, which would increase to $100 per day from the 25th day of trial, more than a typical jury receives. Crown Attorney Kevin Gowdy opened for the prosecution and warned them that the evidence that would be presented would be graphic and hard to hear. He laid out the prosecution's case that Tori Stafford was found wearing just a Hannah Montana t-shirt 103 days after she went missing. A pathologist would testify that she had suffered multiple blows to the head with a hammer and blunt force impacts to her body that had fractured her ribs and lacerated her liver. Attorney Gowdy told the jury that Michael Rafferty and Terry Lynn McClintock had abducted, sexually assaulted and brutally beaten the little girl to death before hiding her remains in a secluded location. Attorney Gowdy informed the jury that it was not up to them to figure out who had dealt the fatal blows to the little girl, but to determine whether or not the accused and McClintock had acted together. He said, "In the end, it is not necessary or essential that you determine exactly who did what, for example, which of the two delivered the hammer blows to the skull, or who inflicted the trauma to Tori's body that lacerated her liver and broke her ribs." Attorney Gowdy also said that McClintock would be called to testify and that when the jury heard her evidence, they would unquestionably be disturbed by the choices that she made with Michael Rafferty. He also acknowledged that McClintock's credibility would be a major issue in the case because of the role she played in Tori's murder, but advised the jurors to listen to her evidence carefully and cautiously. He told the jury about evidence that would be presented, including Rafferty's Honda Civic, which contained DNA evidence. Sitting in the gallery during opening proceedings, Rodney Stafford later told the media that he had every faith in the Crown and the police who investigated the case. Rafferty's attorney, Dirk Durstein, had asked everybody to keep an open mind and not rush to judgment. The following day, Laura Perry, the mother of one of Tori's classmates, testified that she had seen Tori walking with a young woman on April 8, 2009, and that they looked to be in a hurry. She later spoke with police and helped them compose a sketch of the woman who was seen, who was later identified as being Terry Lynn McClintock. Jennifer Griffin Morrell, Tori's teacher, testified that she was a happy and attentive student. Ontario Provincial Police Detective Constable Robin Brocanier. Ontario Provincial Police Detective Constable Robin Brocanier testified that he had been in charge of obtaining the video footage following Tori's abduction. He spoke about the CCTV footage that showed Tori walking with a person of interest across from College Avenue Secondary School towards a retirement home car park. Footage was also obtained of a dark-coloured car pulling into the parking lot and later leaving again. On the third day of evidence, Ontario Provincial Police Constable Gary Scoyne testified that the police had collected 1,100 pieces of physical evidence and took over 4,000 photographs during the investigation. Speaking about the sheer size of the case, he said, "I have worked on major cases before, but the volume of this was enormous and the amount of personnel was too." Constable Scoyne showed the jury 52 photographs taken of the area where Tori was last seen. They also saw pictures of College Avenue Secondary School, where the CCTV footage had been obtained from. Constable Scoyne was in charge of the exhibit management during the investigation and would be called to testify numerous times throughout the trial. Oxford Community Police Staff Sergeant Paul Hess was also called to testify for the Crown. He stated that he became aware of Tory's disappearance at 6:04 p.m. on April 8th. A police unit were sent to search her school and the surrounding area, but no trace of the little girl was found. Tara MacDonald, Tory's mother, also testified on March 7th. She had not been allowed to attend the earlier proceedings as witnesses must not be influenced by previous testimony. She said that she had suffered from an OxyContin addiction and had in fact taken drugs on the afternoon of Tory's disappearance. She also admitted to meeting McClintock twice before when she went to her home to purchase drugs. On April 8th, Tara had asked Darren to walk Tory home from school, but he had brought another child home, and when he went back to find Tory, she was gone. They began looking for her around the neighbourhood at around 4:30 p.m, and Tara called her mother to help just after 5 p.m. Their house was just over a block and a half from the school. Tara described Tory as a tomboy who was also a girly girl. She loved to dress up, but also had no problem getting dirty or playing with bugs. This part of who Tory was is embodied in her school photograph. The little girl had gone to school picture perfect in a pretty outfit, but snuck a pair of football boots in her bag and wore them for the photo. The next day, Detective Constable Sean Kelly told the court that after the surveillance footage of Tory walking with an unknown woman was released on April 9th, her mother, Tara, had rang to say she recognised the woman as Terry Lynn McClintock. McClintock was later arrested for an outstanding warrant and would confess to her involvement some weeks later. Detective Constable Kelly struggled to hold back tears when he spoke about how the officers spent 16 to 20 hours a day looking for Tory and then learned that the investigation went from an abduction case to homicide. This episode is sponsored by Elfster. It's almost that time of year and nothing crushes your Christmas spirit faster than the stress of organising gifts for everyone. Elfster is the number one Secret Santa app in the world. Elfster makes giving gifts easier by allowing you to create a free gift exchange. All you have to do is set the date and budget and Elfster will take care of the rest. They even draw the names for you. You can make wish lists to share with your family and friends to make sure that everyone gets the gift they really want. You can add gifts to your wish list from your favourite brands like Amazon, Etsy, Fanatics, Nordstrom and more. You can also shop from curated gift guides. Elfster is trusted by more than 17 million people to arrange their Secret Santa gift exchange. Go to elfster.com or download the Elfster app. It's E-L-F-S-T-E-R. Elfster.
The trial resumed after the weekend on March 13th. Terry Lynn McClintock, who pleaded guilty to murder in 2010, took the stand. She detailed the last few hours of Tory Stafford's life, saying she lured her to Rafferty's car under the guise that she would show her a dog. Rafferty had said to just talk about dogs or candy and urged her to kidnap a little girl. Tory was then forced into the back seat and covered with Rafferty's black pea coat. Rafferty allegedly complained that the 8-year-old wasn't young enough. When Tory asked where they were going, McClintock said that she replied and said they were going for a drive. Tory asked if she could go home and promised not to tell anyone. She said that she would just say she was playing with her cousin. They drove along Highway 401 to Guelph, Ontario, where they purchased coffee, drugs, garbage bags and a claw hammer. McClintock said that Rafferty then drove into a rural area and turned down a laneway. She then described the brutal sexual assault inflicted on Tory Stafford. In her initial statement to the police, she had said that Rafferty had been the one to kill Tory. But on the stand, she said that it had been her who had kicked and beat the girl before moving her body under a tree. The pair went to great lengths to conceal their crime, including messing up the tyre tracks on the laneway. They cleaned the car inside and out, changed their clothes, disposed of the evidence in dumpsters or by throwing them out the window. And Rafferty even had McClintock cut sections out of the back seat as they drove back to Woodstock. Terry Lynn McClintock had several convictions and a bad temper. She had a troubled youth, her biological mother was an exotic dancer who couldn't raise her, and gave her to another dancer named Carol. Carol already had two children who'd been taken into care, and she and Terry Lynn moved at least 8 times before they arrived in Woodstock, the year before Tori Stafford was taken. Children's Aid had been warned about abuse and drug use in the home, but nothing was done. McClintic had to look after herself and unfortunately followed in her adopted mother's footsteps and began smoking cannabis aged just 8 years old, before graduating to harder drugs like cocaine, ecstasy, morphine and OxyContin. She'd left school after grade 8 and became increasingly violent. By the time she was 17, she had 6 assault convictions, including one incident where she'd hit her adopted mother so hard in the face that she caused her to lose most of her vision in one eye. After moving to Woodstock in 2008, she was arrested for robbing 2 people, one which she stabbed and then resisting arrest. According to one of Carol's other children, Terry Lynn and Carol would shoot up OxyContin and Percocet together. Carol was on disability benefits and also sold drugs to fund her addiction. McClintic claimed to have been sexually abused by men Carol would bring home, and she kept a journal filled with violent fantasies, some of which she expressed to a friend while incarcerated in 2008. She said, "I just want to be on the road and take the first person I see, grab them, bring them with me, mutilate the shit out of them, smash their skull apart, then piece it together like a puzzle. That way they stay conscious of the pain I'm inflicting on them." As a child, she admitted putting a dog in a microwave until it screamed. The dog had to be put down as a result. She said that she met Rafferty several months before Tori's murder and they often took drugs or had sex. McClintic's testimony continued the following day. It was revealed that after she was arrested for an unrelated warrant in April 2009, she had listed Rafferty as her boyfriend so that he could visit her in the detention centre. Rafferty was questioned after this as an associate of McClintic's, but denied being in a relationship with her or knowing anything about Tori Stafford's abduction. Rafferty went to visit McClintic in jail and they spoke on the phone. McClintic said they had planned on running away together like Bonnie and Clyde, and that she'd take the fall for everything, saying, "He had more to lose than I did. I'm an 18-year-old junkie anyway." Rafferty allegedly replied, "You'll do anything for a bit of love, eh?" Evidence was presented from McClintic's journal. She'd written down questions the police may ask her and answered that Rafferty had told her to provide. It was a lie based on meeting Tori on the street for a few minutes before driving to go shopping. When she spoke with the police on May 19th, she said that she admitted what happened because she felt like it was the right thing to do. Just the week before she was arrested, she'd been distributing missing persons flyers to help find Tori, while she knew exactly where she was. The jury were given a break on March 15th as the legal teams discussed an issue that had arisen, and McClintic continued to speak from the dock the following day. Crown attorney Kevin Gowdy began questioning McClintic on the statement she gave to police about Tori's murder. In it, she'd stated that Rafferty had been the one to kill Tori, but on the stand, she insisted that she had been the one who wielded the claw hammer and kicked the girl. Video evidence of the interview was shown to the court in which McClintic was shown saying that it had been Rafferty that killed Tori, and only admitting to kicking her a couple of times. When asked why she had now changed the story, McClintic said, "I could not accept that I was capable of committing something so heinous." She said that it had been Rafferty who wanted to abduct and rape a child, so she wanted him to be the monster that killed her as well. She said that if she didn't say it was him, he could have gone and done it again to another child. Justice Heaney told the jury that they could not use McClintic's unsworn statement to the police to decide the case because she had insisted under oath at trial that she'd been the one to kill Tori. The jury could use her conflicting statements to determine her credibility, though. The court was dismissed until March 21st, and Justice Heaney reminded the jurors to keep a completely open mind as they'd only heard evidence from the prosecution and the trial would continue for some time.
On McClintock's fourth day on the witness stand, she was cross-examined by the defence attorney, Dirk Durstein. Attorney Durstein asked about the letters she had written while incarcerated between 2007 and 2008, in which she referred were fantasies about killing and torturing others. She spoke about wanting to go on a killing spree and wanting to fight while in jail. In response, McClintock said she had been full of anger and rage at that time of her life and could not recall all of the things she said or did. Durstein spoke about her clearly violent tendencies, speaking about the assaults she had committed on her mother and others. In one instance, she had held her mother in a chokehold with one hand while repeatedly punching her in the face with the other, causing her to lose some vision in her eye. Photographic evidence of her mother's injuries were admitted into evidence, as was the rest of McClintock's criminal history, which was extremely violent. She had been charged with assault after punching her mother in the back of the head. She said it was because her mother had burned her with a cigarette. Another time, she had attempted to rob two men while holding a knife and even stabbed one of them. When the police arrived, she did not comply and punched an officer in the face. McClintock said she had been seeing counsellors to deal with her anger issues and did not deny that she had a history of violence. She denied ever being violent to children, and she could not comprehend the fact that a child lost their life by her hands. Justice Heaney made the decision to allow McClintock's interview tape into evidence. He had said that it could only be used to determine McClintock's credibility, but now the jurors could use her statements to police as evidence in deciding the case. He did emphasise that sworn evidence like trial testimony is stronger than that made outside of a court. During the interview tape, McClintock speaks about how Tory begs her to stop Rafferty as he sexually assaults her, and that she saw Rafferty kick the girl more than once before he killed her with the hammer. The following day, McClintock was asked about her relationship with the defendant Michael Rafferty. She said they had been seeing each other and at one stage had gone to a pawn shop to try on rings. Attorney Durstein asked why, if they had only been seeing each other, would she go along with his plan to abduct a child? She responded that he had a very powerful role in her life at that time. McClintock said that Rafferty called her a few days after the murder and told her to change her appearance, so she dyed her hair. Attorney Durstein asked McClintock if her story would change again, and she replied that it had taken her a long time to accept that she was capable of something like that, but now that she had come to terms with it, she was telling the truth and her story would not change. On March 23rd, attorneys for the defence said that Michael Rafferty did not know that McClintock was going to abduct a child and that McClintock had been the engine in the case. She had been the one to lure Tory away. She was the one seen buying the murder weapon. McClintock said she had been instructed to do so by Rafferty, but the defence attorney said that she had brought Tory to the car and offered her to Rafferty sexually. Then when he was uninterested, she instructed him to drive to a remote area where she told Rafferty to walk away. The defence's scenario was one in which McClintock pretended Tory was afraid of Rafferty, and while he stepped away, she killed the little girl, leaving Rafferty horrified, but he offered to help cover it up. McClintock completely denied that that was what happened. Next to testify was Ontario Provincial Police Detective Constable Colin Derman. He said that there had been many persons of interest investigated after over 5,000 tips came into the team. McClintock's name came up time and time again as a known associate of Tara MacDonald and her boyfriend James Gorris. When the police spoke with the McClintock's neighbours, they were told about Rafferty. The police met with Rafferty at his home and an audio recording of the interview was played in court. He said that he only knew of Tory Stafford's disappearance from media reports and he was just friends with McClintock and was helping her mother while she was in jail. After learning that Rafferty drove a car similar to the one seen on CCTV the day Tory was abducted, the police planned to take photos, but the car was not present when they returned the following day. Detective Constable Jarman said that Rafferty had no previous criminal history when they began looking at him after Tory's abduction. On March 27th, a woman named Barbara Armstrong testified that she had sold drugs to Michael Rafferty from her home in Guelph on April 8, 2009 at around 4:30 p.m. Miss Armstrong said that Rafferty had parked his blue Honda Civic near the house and while he was inside buying Percocets, a dark-haired woman was sitting in the car waiting. The prosecution said that McClintock was the dark-haired woman and that she was in the car with Tory Stafford. Miss Armstrong said she had met Rafferty about a week later and he looked super stressed. She said he told her that he hadn't been sleeping or eating well. They also discussed Tori Stafford's disappearance. Rafferty said that he heard the girl's mother owed drug money and that he planned to help look for her. Ontario Provincial Police Sergeant Dave Vitti spoke about CCTV footage that had been obtained showing stops McClintock and Rafferty made along their route to the crime scene. Sergeant Vitti also showed the court Rafferty's bank records, showing he had withdrawn $80 in cash from a gas station along the way, money that McClintock used to buy the hammer and garbage bags. She was shown on CCTV in the Home Depot, calmly purchasing the items that would be later used to kill and hide Tori Stafford. Constable Gary Scoyne, who had testified previously, presented photographic evidence of what Rafferty and McClintock did in Guelph on the day Tori was killed.
On March 28th, a woman named Lillian Metcalf testified that around the time of Tori's murder, she'd been walking along Side Road 6 and found a pair of white shoes and a single trainer. Miss Metcalf took the pair of shoes home, where she washed them with the intention of donating them to charity. On May 30th, police were canvassing the area and she described there had been a backseat of a car in the area along the road a few weeks previously, but it wasn't there anymore. After she described finding the shoes, the officer asked her about them, and she responded that she still had them in the house. The blue and white Shaq baseball shoes were identified by McClintock as belonging to her. They were the shoes she'd thrown out the car window after Tori was murdered. After a break, the trial resumed on March 30th. Detective Sergeant Jim Smith from the Ontario Provincial Police testified in the morning. Detective Smith is a widely respected officer who happened to be the one Russell Williams, the military man turned murderer, confessed to. Smith said that he was brought in with the OPP on April 17th to assist in the investigation of Tori Stafford's abduction. Smith interviewed McClintock on May 19th and she admitted her involvement in Tori's abduction and murder. She also said that Michael Rafferty had raped and killed the child. When McClintock agreed to assist the officers in their search for Tori's remains, Smith brought her to Guelph, but McClintock was unsure of what direction they'd taken. Smith brought McClintock on searches a number of times, including aerial searches, but they found nothing. After obtaining cell phone records from Rafferty's phone on July 17th, Smith realised they'd not been searching far enough north. Phone records placed Rafferty in the Mount Forest area on April 8th. On July 17th, Smith went to Mount Forest to do some reconnaissance and provide search teams with suggested areas to check. But when he was driving, he recognised the house as being similar to the one McClintock has described as being at an angle. He noticed it was across the road from the house. Driving down the laneway, he crossed a culvert, as McClintock had said, and then at the top of the inclined laneway, he saw a rock pile among evergreen trees, just as McClintock had described. As he got closer to the rock pile, he noted a slight odour of what he believed to be decomposition. After taking a rock off the pile and touching a green garbage bag, he said he believed that he'd finally found Victoria Stafford. He called it in and investigators arrived on the scene shortly after with forensic teams and the pathologist. Detective Sergeant Smith attended Tori Stafford's funeral on July 31st and then had no further involvement in the case. Constable Gary Scoyne had called to testify again. He went through photographs taken of the crime scene, the laneway, the tree line, the rock pile, the broken body beneath the garbage bags. The next day, jurors were taken to the scene to better understand the testimony and evidence that had been presented in court. On April 3rd, the owner of the land Tori's body was found on testified that he rarely uses the laneway and that the conditions around April 8th, 2009 were wet, slushy and covered with snow. Dr. Michael Pollinan testified about the autopsy he conducted on Tori Stafford's body the day after it was discovered. Dr. Pollinan said that the little girl was found wearing only a t-shirt and the clothing she'd been wearing on the lower half was not recovered. Her butterfly earrings were also found with her body. As graphic autopsy photographs were shown to the jury, Dr. Pollinan described the injuries that could be seen. There were numerous rib fractures that Dr. Pollinan believed to have been caused by kicking or stomping. When he examined the lung tissue, he found evidence of liver damage, which meant that Tori was likely alive when her liver was lacerated. This would have caused internal bleeding and incredible pain. She had received at least 4 blows to the head with a hammer some penetrating her skull. The internal bleeding may have contributed to her death, but the blows inflicted by the claw hammer were fatal. The level of decomposition meant that it was impossible to determine if she was sexually assaulted. Throughout the trial, many of Tori's family members wore purple, her favourite colour. On the day that the pathologist listed the horrific manner in which she died, Michael Rafferty wore a purple shirt. Dr. Polonen was cross-examined the following day. Attorney Durstin asked him to clarify that science and his skills as a pathologist could not tell the court who inflicted the wounds, which Dr. Polonen agreed was correct. Durstin also asked about any evidence of sexual assault. The pathologist had already said that the remains were too decomposed and answered that the medical evidence was silent on sexual assault. Sergeant John James Sterling of the OPP testified that the search efforts undertaken by officers from a number of different forces, the hundreds of officers covered more than 18,000 kilometres, the largest operation in Ontario. Sergeant Sterling said, "We went 1.5 times around the moon." McClintic was flown hundreds of kilometres in a helicopter looking for something familiar to try and pinpoint the location of Tori's body, and over 50 kilometres of the highway were searched on foot to try and find the evidence that McClintic had said she'd thrown out the window. Testimony was given about Rafferty's arrest on May 19, 2009, and evidence that was seized from his home, his car and McClintic's home too. In McClintic's home, they found a missing persons poster for Tori and a piece of paper with Tara's number written on it, with the words "Tori's mother." There was also a box of hair dye found. A missing persons poster for Tori was also found in Rafferty's home, and a receipt for the hair dye found in McClintic's home. Police also found the black pea coat McClintic said was used to hide Tori in the back seat of the car. Two blonde hairs were found on the coat. Constable Scoyne showed photos of the evidence to the jury, including water bottles with caps like the ones found at Tori's body. Speaking about the evidence found in the Honda Civic Rafferty's owned, Constable Scoyne said that it had been painted on the inside with white spray paint and the window handles in the back of the car had been removed. A gym bag was found in the car. On it was a mixture of blood from Tori and semen from Rafferty. Forensic biologist Jennifer McLean testified that a sample of blood collected from the rear passenger door moulding was compared to Tori Stafford's DNA. A profile had been created using DNA from her parents, one of her teeth and hair from a comb. The DNA found matched her profile, meaning the likelihood that it was not her blood was 1 in 150 trillion. The mixture of blood and semen found on the back of the front passenger seat could not be directly matched to anyone, but it also could not exclude Rafferty or Tori. A piece of fabric was found inside the Honda Civic when police seized it. A fibre expert from the Centre of Forensic Sciences, Barbara Dupe, said that it had been cut with a knife and matched a sample taken from another Honda Civic, bolstering McClintic's claim that Rafferty had instructed her to cut a portion of the seat out with a knife. On April 12th, more testimony was given about Rafferty from a woman he'd met on a dating site. She said that following Tori's abduction, Rafferty would constantly check media reports on the case and claim to have inside information about her mother's drug use. Sarah Hodge said that when she met Rafferty, the back seat of his Civic had been removed. She also said that he'd changed his status on the dating site to "bring Tori home." Neighbours of Rafferty testified that they'd seen a car seat in front of his home for garbage pickup around the same time. Rafferty seemed to be a serial dater, as many more of the witnesses were women he was seeing at the time. One said that he knew the Mount Forest area well, and they'd driven down side roads there before. A landscaper, who'd employed Rafferty, told the jury that he'd worked at a landfill about 5 kilometres from the laneway where Tori was killed. Other women he dated gave evidence about his behaviour and demeanour following McClintic's arrest, and how he spoke about feeling as if he was treated as guilty by association. On April 19th, the court was shown Rafferty's cell phone records, showing that although he used his phone in the Mount Forest area on April 8, 2009, there were times when his phone showed no activity, unusual for the man who was dating almost a dozen women at the same time. More evidence of Rafferty's character was admitted. One ex-girlfriend told of how he'd asked her to work as an escort and had received almost $17,000 from her in a six-month period. His phone records also showed calls between him and McClintock while she was in a Genis Centre for Youth Detention Centre. The Crown finished presenting evidence, and the defence called one witness. The woman said that she saw a young woman wearing a white ski jacket near the school on the day that Tori was abducted, and that she seemed like a woman on a mission. She said that she saw a little girl following the woman, and she seemed happy. The witness stated that she was not happy to testify for the defence.
Closing arguments began on May 7th. Attorney Durstein for the defence said that McClintock was an accomplished liar and the engine behind Tori Stafford's abduction and murder. He pointed out inconsistencies in her statements and called her credibility into question, saying that she willfully, carefully, and with real skill attempted and often succeeded in misleading police officers. He asked the jury to act without emotion and judge it fairly despite it being set against an unspeakable tragedy. It was the defence's contention that Rafferty was just a spectator and had no idea that McClintock was going to abduct or kill the young woman. Attorney Durstein said there was no medical evidence that Rafferty raped Tori Stafford, and there was no evidence he orchestrated her kidnapping and murder. The defence attorney told the jury that McClintock lied about everything except one thing, saying, "I still urge you to find that you could find beyond a reasonable doubt that she was the one who bashed in poor Tori Stafford's head." The following day, the Crown gave their closing argument. Attorney Gowdy said, "Rafferty knew from the very beginning, because he was the leader of the operation, and that there was no way he would go along with a kidnapping otherwise." The attorney said that McClintock was a violent pawn used to carry out Rafferty's plan, and that they acted together and were guilty together. It was the prosecution's allegation that Rafferty drove Tori to Mount Forest because he knew it was a remote area where he could abuse, kill, and conceal Tori Stafford. Attorney Gowdy summarised the evidence presented throughout the lengthy trial and played clips from Rafferty's interview with the police and clips that showed he was lying. The prosecutor went through 25 things that McClintock had said that were backed up by evidence, saying that she was more credible than defence would have them believe. The big inconsistency was that she changed her story to say that she was the one who killed Tori, a move which Attorney Gowdy believed was to try and avoid testifying at the trial. He said, "Don't believe everything she says, but do believe something she says. She is not an innocent eyewitness." The attorney explained to the jury the different manners in which a person can be found guilty of first-degree murder. Intentionally killing them in the course of a kidnapping, or helping someone else commit murder. Gowdy said that it didn't matter who actually dealt the fatal blow, because they acted together, that was enough to convict. To further bolster their contention that McClintock was lying about being the one to kill Tori, they said that her excuse of snapping due to childhood trauma would more likely lead her to kill the man who was sexually assaulting a child, not the child. He said that Rafferty visited McClintock when she was in juvenile detention because he wanted to maintain control over her and make sure she didn't tell the police the truth. The following day, Justice Thomas Heaney gave the jury instructions before they were due to deliberate. He told them that for the murder charge, they could return a verdict of guilty of manslaughter if they believed McClintock was the one to kill Tori, guilty of second or first degree murder, or not guilty. They also had to return a verdict of guilty or not guilty of abduction and sexual assault. He instructed the jury to rise above emotional consideration and told them to dispassionately decide the case based solely on the evidence and the law. They were then sent to deliberate. The 8-week trial had seen 61 witnesses take the stand and almost 200 pieces of evidence exhibited. The following day, May 11, 2011, the jury reached a verdict. In the courtroom, they returned a verdict of guilty of first-degree murder, sexual assault causing bodily harm, and kidnapping. Michael Rafferty was remanded into custody until a sentencing hearing on May 15th. On May 15th, Victoria's older brother Darren delivered a heartbreaking statement at Rafferty's sentencing hearing. He spoke how his life had changed, how he had been impacted. He said his mother was an addict to deal with the loss, and his father always had what happened on his mind. he felt like he was known as Victoria Stafford's brother. Michael Rafferty then delivered his own statement. In it, he said that he would give Victoria's mother's the missing pieces of the puzzle if she wanted them. He also maintained that he was innocent. Judge Heaney said that the verdict was justly and amply supported by evidence and sentenced Rafferty to the mandatory sentence for murder of life in prison with no possibility of parole for 25 years, with 10 years to be served concurrently for both the kidnapping and sexual assault charges. Justice Heaney said, "Your crimes have destroyed the lives of Victoria Stafford's parents, her brother, her extended family and loved ones. They have terrorised an entire community who had thought its children could safely walk its streets, little knowing that people such as you lurked among them. That you were brought to justice is due entirely to the most massive and extraordinary mobilisation of police resources that this province and probably this country has ever seen. You snuffed out the life of a beautiful, talented, vivacious little girl. And for what? So that you could gratify your twisted and deviant desire to have sex with a child. Only a monster could commit an act of such pure evil. You, sir, are a monster." Statements by Tori's family were read in court. Tara, her mother, said that she still had to deal with people thinking she was involved in her daughter's murder, and that every milestone she was looking forward to, like graduation or her wedding, had been replaced by anniversaries of her abduction and the day she was found dead. Darren, Tori's brother, wrote a statement that was read by a member of the prosecution, attorney Stephanie Venn. In it, he said how close he had been to Tori, and now how he felt alone and as if there was an empty spot in his heart. He spoke about how he had to go to counselling and suffered from low self-esteem and anxiety. He said that he was lost without his baby sister and best friend. It had been publicised after the jury began deliberating that some evidence had not been admitted into the trial. Information uncovered on Rafferty's BlackBerry and computer showed that he had child sex abuse images and had searched on the internet for violent child abuse imagery. Victoria Stafford's family had to wait 103 days for her body to be found, and 3 years for justice.
Michael Rafferty attempted to appeal his conviction and was denied legal aid. The taxpayer had to fund his appeal. The appeal stated that the trial judge made a number of errors when instructing the jury and in admitting certain evidence into court. Attorney Paul Clarko represented Rafferty in the appellate hearing and said that Rafferty's actions after Tori's murder were consistent with being an accessory after the fact, like when he disposed of his clothes, backseat of the car, gave a false alibi and lied to the police consistently. The Court of Appeal said, "There was simply no evidence upon which a properly instructed jury acting reasonably could have found the appellant guilty solely of being an accessory. There was by evidential foundation or air of reality for the appellant's submission that he was simply helping McClintock after she committed the offences. On the contrary, a large body of evidence contradicted this theory." Appeal Court Justice John Laskin rebutted Clarko when the attorney said the trial judge erred when he did not issue a retrovec warning to the jury. A retrovec warning is when the trial judge advises a jury to consider the reliability of the testimony when it's coming from a witness with poor credibility. The content of this warning is discretionary and the judge can decide what to say or if to say anything. The defence attorney at Rafferty's trial had not asked the judge to give the jury a retrovec warning, likely to allow the defence to discredit McClintock as a witness themselves and strengthen any future appeals. Justice Heaney did advise the jury that McClintock had changed her statement in her sworn testimony and to consider that when they were assessing her credibility. The appeal court found no errors made and told Clarko that he had argued an extremely difficult appeal very well. But the appellate judge simply did not agree with him and dismissed the case before the Crown even had to make their submissions to contest it. Following the high level of publicity the case received and the prominence of drug abuse within those surrounding Tori Stafford, Woodstock was labelled as somewhere with severe OxyContin problem. Approved in the mid-90s, OxyContin became the most prescribed branded narcotic medication for people with moderate to severe pain. It was marked as being non-addictive and safe. Less than a decade later, More and more reports came in about the misuse of the prescription medication which contains the opioid oxycodone. The drug was marketed fiercely as a treatment for pain in cancer patients and patients without cancer who suffered from mild to severe pain. General practitioners and primary care specialists were encouraged to prescribe the drug, which is twice as potent as morphine. According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, almost 50,000 people in the United States died from opioid-related overdoses in 2019. One in five people prescribed opioids will misuse them. 4-6% of those will transition to heroin. While overprescribing of opioids is one of the main causes of this crisis, another is that the drug offers an escape to people in disadvantaged socioeconomic circumstances or those suffering from abuse or trauma. There is no easy fix. New formulas of analgesic opioids which are supposed to be harder to interfere with and misuse can lead to desperation and demand in those addicted. Fentanyl, a synthetic opioid that is 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine, is produced and distributed illegally. This is the most common drug involved in overdose deaths in the US. There needs to be a safer environment for addicts and more accessible services for them to get help through medication like methadone and psychological therapy. Terry Lynn McClintock, who's not eligible for parole for another decade, was transferred to an Indigenous healing lodge, Okimor Oki. It's a healing lodge for Aboriginal women on Nakanit First Nation in Saskatchewan from the Grand Valley Institution for Women, where she'd been serving her sentence. The healing lodge works in a similar way to prison, but its focus is on healing. It's not as restrictive as a medium security prison and works with offenders and Indigenous elders to rehabilitate them. McClintock's family denies she has Indigenous ancestry, so moving the convicted child killer to a minimum security facility that teaches the residents the practices of cultures and values of the Nakani seemed like McClintock was receiving privileges. And although she seems remorseful in her statement at her plea hearing and during Rafferty's trial, she's not changed her ultra-violent ways. In 2012, she was convicted for kicking and beating another inmate as they lay on the floor and said that her only regret was not causing the woman more severe injuries than she had. New policy changes meant that McClintock was transferred back to prison from the healing lodge. Victoria Stafford would be 21 years old today if she'd not been abducted by Terry Lynn McClintock and Michael Rafferty. Rodney Stafford continues to campaign for victims, support for those impacted by homicide, and just recently called for a review of the Canadian Victim Bill of Rights. He also completed a charity bike ride to raise funds. Tara McDonald struggled to get past the public perception of her as a bad mother, despite her having nothing to do with Tori's abduction and murder. She suffered with post-traumatic stress disorder, but has since started practicing as a doula, assisting women as they give birth. In an interview with CTV, she said that her son Darren was studying and had started his own online business. He'd posted on social media saying, "I'm doing this for us, Victoria. Everything I do for the both of us."
Thank you for listening to this episode of Crime Labs. Crime Labs is an independent podcast that is funded in part by our generous Patreon supporters. If you enjoy the show and want to help us keep it going, you can join us on patreon.com/crimelabs. And in exchange for your pledge, you'll get access to early release ad-free episodes, bonus content, and exclusive merchandise. You can also support the show by subscribing and leaving us a 5-star review. You can keep up to date with us on social media at CrimeLapse on Instagram and Facebook, and at CrimeLapsePod on Twitter. Stay safe.